Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wouldn't it be great if we knew how much oil was still out there waiting to be found? Imagine how much more sane that would make the markets. We don't know, of course. We're just working with educated guesses. And the group that is the most educated said today, it's worried we're running out of crude. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends can stay in touch. People are talking at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday. It is the 22nd of May today, and this was a day of relative calm in world oil markets. After a spike above $135 a barrel overnight, crude has tipped back to about $130. Look out, though, because if the International Energy Agency is right, that might be nothing. The IEA's got a reputation as a straight shooter when it comes to oil supplies. The group said today it's working on a revamp of its current estimates, a survey of how fast we're using up what crude we do have. We asked Marketplace's John Dimsdale to find out whether oil companies have been looking hard enough.
The IEA's review of the world's biggest 400 oil fields won't be ready until November, and the agency won't speculate on the conclusions, but the Wall Street Journal reports the initial findings are that supplies of various liquid fuels will fall short of expected demand by 2030. The reason? Aging, depleted oil fields and a lack of investment in new ones.
It's definitely a move in a more pessimistic direction.
Sarah Banizak with the American Petroleum Institute says as oil becomes more expensive, demand will go down as conservation and alternative fuels become more attractive. Still, she says U.S. companies are pouring plenty of money into finding new oil fields.
They're doing as much as they can, and they're investing record amounts. But it's also true that the publicly held oil companies of the United States don't control the lion's share of the world's resources.
More than 80% are owned by nationalized oil companies. Daniel Juergen of Cambridge Energy Research Associates says the U.S. should be encouraging those oil-rich nations to open up their industries to foreign investment.
For instance, the U.S. government played a very important role in the 1990s encouraging investment in countries like Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan, and seeing that the pipeline was developed, and now there's 1 million barrels a day flowing out of Azerbaijan to the Mediterranean.
It takes 10 or 15 years to develop new oil fields, and Juergen hopes today's high prices and concerns about the future will generate more investments in energy sources of all kinds. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
As long as we're on oil, let's take a tour to Detroit here for a second. It wasn't so long ago, just a month in fact, that Ford executives were popping the champagne and predicting a return to profitability by the end of this year. You might say they're feeling a little hungover today. This morning, Ford announced it's going to have to cut production. And as for a return to black ink, CEO Alan Mulally won't even say whether we can expect that by 2010. From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Back in April, Ford surprised investors with news of a profitable first quarter, partly because of cost-cutting measures that were actually working and partly because of good sales overseas. As for the prediction it would be profitable by next year, consultant Ron Harber says the company clearly miscalculated.
There's a multitude of variables in that model, and one of them has to do with product mix and also, you know, what volume would be and that, you know, where inflation would be and money costs and so on and so forth. Gas prices, you name it. So since so many of those independent and uncontrollable variables have changed.
The cost of raw materials keeps going up. Americans are buying fewer new vehicles than they were. And in the last few weeks, it's become clear that people really are moving away from gas-guzzling SUVs and pickups for good. People who are still buying new cars are going for smaller and more fuel-efficient ones. Bob Schultz is with Standard & Poor's.
Hurts disproportionately companies like Ford and GM and Chrysler that are less focused on the smaller vehicles. So it will be painful in terms of just they make less money on the smaller vehicles.
Ford says it's planning to build more of those smaller vehicles, but that it'll keep trying to cut costs by making even fewer vehicles overall and offering buyouts at more plants. Schultz says the real concern with today's announcement is what it says about Ford's turnaround. If the slow sales and lots of cash spending continue into next year, it could take longer than the company or investors thought to get profitable. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Much like car companies, big financial institutions have seen better days. The subprime mess led the Swiss bank UBS to a disastrous first quarter. UBS lost $11 billion, due mostly to its investments in mortgage-backed securities. The trend has been for banks to do what they have to get those securities off their books, but there are firms that think they'll eventually be worth something again. And today, UBS did a deal with one of them. It sold $15 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities to BlackRock, the asset management firm. And this is going to sound a little nuts here, but UBS is going to lend BlackRock more than $11 billion to make sure that sale actually happens. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite explains.
UBS needs money now. That's why it's selling the loans at a deep discount. They used to be worth $22 billion. Benjamin Wallace is a securities analyst with Grimes & Company. He says BlackRock is happy to take on that debt and bide its time.
Because BlackRock's not in a distressed situation, they can afford to wait for the values to come back. UBS is in a more stressed situation, and they're just looking to mitigate risk.
Wallace says in exchange for its risky mortgage-backed debt, UBS is taking on an $11.25 billion loan to BlackRock, and BlackRock's a much safer bet. Bert Ely is a banking consultant. He says BlackRock could really cash in by buying all these securities. He says their value could easily rebound.
Now, it may take a few years for that that profit to be earned. Some of it will come sooner rather than later. But while this is a high-risk investment, it also promises some very high returns.
UBS isn't the only bank looking to offload subprime debt. Christopher Whalen of Institutional Risk Analytics says we can expect to see more deals like this one.
I do not expect valuations for these securities to bounce this year. It's very hard if you're a distressed seller and you have to go out and deal with aggressive buyers to get a good price.
Ironically, that's good news for the people who designed these Byzantine products, many of whom have lost their jobs. Banks like UBS will need them to work out just how much these assets are worth. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Traders dithered for most of the day, catching their breath after yesterday. I'd imagine we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Foreign companies have been getting a bad rap in the Chinese blogosphere this week. There have been complaints that big multinationals like McDonald's and Pfizer haven't made large enough contributions to earthquake relief. Today, the Minister of Commerce went on television saying quite the opposite, that donations from foreign companies in China have come to about $280 million in cash and supplies so far. The scale of the disaster, 51,000 lives by last count and millions more dislocated, has prompted an outpouring of domestic support, too. As Jamila Trindle reports now from southwest China.
At this drop-off point on the road towards the devastated areas of China's Sichuan province, trucks rumble in with supplies from across the country. It is crowded with vans, shiny SUVs, and cars with people bringing supplies and offering help. One group of volunteers were employees from the Blue Sword Bottling Company. After the earthquake hit, they were some of the first volunteers to arrive on the scene.
We got to the school at around 4 o'clock. When we arrived, we used our hands. Our workers dug people out with our hands. And we probably saved around 20 students.
And over a week later, Zhou Zongfeng and 300 of her co-workers are still here, working at relief efforts around the clock.
We have more than 20 vans, and we're driving them to all the rescue points, delivering water for free. We're working 24 hours a day, no rest. We're extremely tired.
Zhou usually works in public relations, but she says this effort isn't about making a good impression.
I think we've done what we should do. We didn't do it for the praise. We truly did this for the victims after seeing their tragic situation.
So many cars showed up on the roads to the quake site, the police cordoned them off and drop off donation points. Thousands of cars and SUVs have come from as far away as Beijing, more than 900 miles to the northeast.
When they came, they brought lots of food, digging tools, excavators and backhoes, everything. Some even drove their own cars to transport materials.
Chen Xiaobing is coordinating one of the refugee camps at a stadium in Shefeng. He says what they really need now is donations.
Right now, people don't have places to live. This needs to be solved because building houses takes a long time. They really need rice, cooking oil, and quilts. These are the most urgent things.
Those in charge are asking volunteers who aren't experts in search and rescue, healthcare, or psychology to go home and consider making a donation instead. Xinhua News Agency said that as of Sunday, donations had totaled $1.3 billion, and 85% of that came from the Chinese themselves. The vast majority of support is coming from government-organized charities, but people have also been quick to act on their own. Though most of the out-of-town volunteers have gone home, this stadium still has plenty of volunteers. They are kids from the local high school, like Wang Yang. After feeling the quake and seeing so much devastation, he has a new sense of responsibility.
Right now, our hometown is devastated. We have to give what we can. To be able to do our part for our hometown makes me feel really good.
Teacher Li Jingjing says seeing the disaster firsthand has made her students want to personally answer the call put out by the Communist Youth League.
Another very important reason, I think, maybe this is the environment, maybe the political environment, because the government call on all those children to participate.
The call to volunteer comes not only from China's central government, but increasingly from China's ever-expanding private sector. Corporations are making large, unprecedented contributions, and their employees, investment bankers, truck drivers, food producers, and factory workers, are contributing their time.
I'm very proud to be a Blue Sword Bottling Company employee. Companies must bear some responsibility for society. Only a socially responsible business can accomplish big things.
As China faces the next big challenge, housing victims and rebuilding the quake zone, many are hoping this new sense of corporate social responsibility will also continue to grow. In Sichuan Province, I'm Jamila Trindle for Marketplace.
Seeing as how it's college graduation time, we've decided to ask three future economists what ought to be a fairly simple question for them by now. Why? What drives an otherwise bright and ambitious young person to subject himself to a lifetime of deciphering regression analyses and using words like resource allocation? For our second installment, Faris Buyan says for him, economics is personal.
Growing up in Bangladesh, I saw poverty eye to eye. The orphan children eating from a dustbin. A family of seven crammed in an 8x8 feet slum hut. The fate of millions in the hands of natural calamities. Widespread poverty is the most malignant cancer faced by humanity, and economics is at the forefront of researching the cure. We live in a world where we're constantly trying to balance personal free will against the reality of scarce resources. To make matters even more difficult, there's the problem of all those self-motivated agents, also known as people. It's not easy stuff, and the prescriptions offered by economists often bear a bitter taste. So yes, the allocation of resources in a civil society is a tricky business. Economists constantly have to engage in zero-sum games that offer benefits for some at the expense of others. Should we choose free trade to bring cheap products for local consumers, but in the process expose some of our important domestic industries to extinction? Will a dollar spent on education lead to more growth than a dollar invested in infrastructure? Trade-offs are not the most pleasant things to deal with. A world without trade-offs would be real fun. But they exist, and someone has to make these important calls. I realize that dismal predictions of what's to come if societies follow their current trend are a hard pill to swallow. But I strongly believe Thomas Carlyle was very short-sighted, unless he was joking, when he dubbed economics the dismal science. Economics predicts and tries to prevent the escalation of misery. If a poor rural woman in Bangladesh can use microcredit to become a businesswoman overnight, and if the East Asian tigers can tackle poverty with miraculous growth over the last 60 years, then surely it's not a bad idea to find the reason behind these success stories.
Faris Buyan is a doctoral candidate in economics at Northwestern University. You can send us your thoughts through our homepage. It's marketplace.org. And while you're there, you can hear why our other young economists chose their line of work. Coming up, Washington power players with a higher calling.
They actually like to refer to themselves jokingly sometimes as the Christian mafia.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials inched up 0.1% today, 24 points to close at 12,625. The NASDAQ gained 0.2%, 16 points, ended at 2464. The S&P 500 added 0.25%, 3 points, finished at 1394. Computer giant IBM clicked up 0.8% on news that first-time jobless claims fell last week. Banking stocks ended their week-long slump. Citigroup picked up more than 3%. JPMorgan Chase gained 1.5%. Retailers also tried on some good news. Limited brands racked up a gain of nearly 3%. That after reporting stronger than expected quarterly profits. Shares in discount giant Walmart bumped up 1.5% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.91%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. And by Clarkson Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for April. A popular pet reptile is in the spotlight. It's World Turtle Day, calling attention to the need to protect these endangered creatures. And actress Joan Collins of Dynasty fame turned 75. Among her numerous film titles is Empire of the Ants, a horror film about not-so-endangered creatures. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Memorial Day is almost upon us, which means summer vacations are too. Those who have travel plans may be celebrating, but seasonal small businesses most definitely aren't, because they will once again find themselves shorthanded. Today, the Labor Department announced some new rules to streamline the visa process for temporary foreign workers. But Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports the federal help comes too late for this summer.
Every summer, businesses like restaurants, hotels, and landscapers rely on an army of temporary foreign workers. They come to the U.S. on H-2B visas, good for 10 months. Congress passed a temporary law that let these workers come back but not be counted in a cap of 66,000 new visas per year. Chad Forsey is a spokesman for the Pennsylvania Landscape and Nursery Association.
I have a business owner in Pittsburgh, and he's got workers who actually have their cars at the apartment complex where he has negotiated an arrangement with the owner.
But Congress's stopgap has expired, so workers can't come back. The new Labor Department rules would extend the H-2B visas to 3 years, but the public has a few months to comment. The Labor Department has to respond before the rules can go into effect. Forsey doubts that'll happen before President Bush leaves office. But Ira Melman of the Federation for American Immigration Reform says there's another solution: hire Americans.
The employers have gotten used to the idea that they can get workers at the price that they want to pay, and they simply don't want to compete in the free market for labor anymore.
The employers say they do pay well and still can't find American workers. Lynn Berleffi heads the Wyoming Lodging and Restaurant Association. She says hotels in sparsely populated tourist towns are especially hard hit.
Many of the managers are cooking in the kitchen, making beds, and it's very difficult to be managing and then always out there.
Berleffi's advice for tourists this summer: be patient. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Americans are going to be taking to the roads and skies in large numbers this long weekend, but some of us are getting a little more green-minded about how we travel for those vacations. The truly aware even calculate their carbon footprint. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Christy George of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
The specter of melting ice and rising sea levels has some folks jetting off to see glaciers or low-lying islands before they're gone. Kim Solem is in charge of corporate social responsibility for the online travel company Expedia. She says some even combine eco-vacationing with helping the environment.
Not to necessarily go back and lie on the beach anymore, but to go see turtles nesting or to go do a Habitat for Humanity volunteer program.
Others are taking the opposite tack.
Any trip I take by airplane puts a huge ding in my carbon footprint.
That's science fiction writer Kim Stanley Robinson. He's hiked Antarctica, the Alps, and the Himalayas. But then he noticed that he could do the same thing closer to home without polluting to get there.
I began to realize I was always comparing them back to the Sierra Nevada, and always the Sierra Nevada was the best. All the other mountain ranges were too big or too cold or too dangerous or too filled with mosquitoes or one thing or another. I came to a little realization, why keep going all over the world when you've got what you want right in your backyard?
These days, Robinson counts his carbon like calories and sticks close to his own backyard in Davis, California. Still, most people just keep on trucking, says Kim Solem at Expedia.
The travel marketplace continues to grow.
She says Americans with a conscience tend, in practice, to take the trip and pay to offset their carbon. Now that people in developing countries have rising disposable incomes, they want to travel just like Americans do. That means flying. Even though cars emit more greenhouse gases, planes emit their gases at high altitudes where they pack a bigger punch. Clark Terry Williams is an environmental economist with the Sightlines Institute in Seattle.
When an airplane is flying high up in the sky, it's putting certain kinds of emissions up, you know, in a place where they can really make a difference.
Commercial aircraft fly high to get above the weather and avoid turbulence. But that has minuses when it comes to contrails, those streaks of white that airplanes leave in the sky.
Contrails at some times of the year in certain altitudes can turn into cirrus clouds, and those have a tendency to trap heat that otherwise would escape into space.
So what do you do if you have a conscience but still want to see those glaciers before they melt? If you must fly, choose a middle seat on a packed plane. A full plane is more fuel efficient, and it's going with or without you. In Portland, Oregon, I'm Christy George for Marketplace.
The popular notion of evangelism in this country is mostly about a social and cultural movement, one that over the years has come to include a certain political agenda, too. But in practice, the American blend of politics, money, and religion is more complicated than that. Jeff Charlotte's a researcher scholar at New York University's Center for Religion and Media. He writes about the group at the center of U.S. economic evangelism in his new book, The Family. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kai. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about the family. It sounds vaguely like the Cosa Nostra.
That's funny because they actually like to refer to themselves jokingly sometimes as the Christian mafia. What they really are is a network of elite evangelicals and government, military, and especially in business that dates back 70 years that identifies the principal teachings of the Bible as related to economics, what many of them call biblical capitalism.
You think elites, and the word rich usually comes to mind. Does that hold in this case?
Indeed, it does. In fact, some of their members in the past have included CEOs of corporations like Raytheon, defense contractor. If you go back in the early roots, they were talking about to folks like Henry Ford and J.C. Penney and some of the really great financiers of conservative power in America. And the family believes that, look, if we can convert these wealthy men, these powerful men, think of all the good they can do for everybody else. Well, that's trickle-down religion. And we've seen how that worked in the economic world, and we can imagine how it works in the religious world.
How do they use that power, that money and the power, to influence life in America and maintain themselves in power?
You know, the family began back in 1935. They organized as an anti-New Deal group that was most concerned with the power of organized labor. And they really saw, in some ways, their first big victory, the rollback of FDR's pro-labor legislation in 1947, something called the Taft-Hartley Act, important piece of legislation in American history, and then moved on to constantly promote free markets, a fundamentalist faith in free markets. Although, you know, some of my libertarian friends point out that what they're doing is not so much free market as cronyism.
Where does the money come from?
The money is interesting. they've developed this practice of sort of opening and closing various nonprofit entities. So it's sort of hard to track the money. When you do, you see that what they're receiving gifts from wealthy men who are invested in their idea of religion, but that also that a lot of the money is moving around off the books. So that, for instance, if you want to donate to the group, the leader might say, well, don't give money to us directly. Why don't we tell you somebody who needs a loan? And the money will move off the books like that.
Sounds a lot like free market evangelism as much as it does Christian conservative evangelism.
Their big insight or their big idea is that in as much as we regulate the market, we are being prideful and we are interfering with God's hand. They believe in this absolute, all-powerful, and most of all, interventionist God, a God who is taking a part in everyday decisions. As the leader Doug Coe says, God doesn't just have opinions about abortion and same-sex marriage. God has opinions about Social Security. God has opinions about financing road construction. And those are the opinions we need to be listening to.
I have to tell you, it all reads like something out of the Da Vinci Code or something.
You know, the family is not a conspiracy. They are part of a strain of American elite religious conservatism. They're not breaking the laws. I mean, in some cases, they're making the laws.
Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
The book by Jeff Charlotte is called The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today may be something Ford CEO Alan Mulally might want to consider, given what we told you earlier. Mark Muller runs an independent car dealership out in Butler, Missouri.
We have Buicks, Pontiacs, Cadillacs, Chevrolets, Dodge, Ford, Jeep, and Chrysler.
Sales have been lagging, so Mr. Muller came up with a new gimmick.
Gas and Guns, that's the name of our sale. Free handgun or gas card with every purchase from now until May 31st.
Gas and Guns.
This old gal come in and bought a white Lincoln from us. I thought she'd picked a gas card. She says, I want my gun.
It's working so well, Mr. Muller says he's probably going to extend it through next month.
All American cars, we fly the American flag, and we carry guns, and we go to church.
And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow plumped up 24 points, just shy of 0.2%. The NASDAQ packed on 16.6%. The S&P 500 gained 3 points. That's about 0.25% there. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, Dirty Water Made Clean. It's as easy as 1, 2, 3.
Insert the filter into the can, and in 15 minutes, it's producing water at a rate of a couple of liters an hour.
Insert with great force, we should probably say. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.